I'm Vermont Edition co-host Bob Kinzel. Just wanted to let you know that this podcast has been edited for brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. In mid-March, the Vermont State Police put out a press release suggesting that one of their troopers had suffered a medical event after conducting a motor vehicle stop and collecting evidence that included a bag of heroin and a syringe. The press release stated that the trooper collapsed sometime later and was revived after being administered 3 doses of Narcan, an opioid reversal drug. And it quoted the head of the state police, Colonel Matthew Birmingham, as saying the following, quote, "There is a new threat that we're seeing up close, the risk of exposure to powerful drugs that can kill in even tiny amounts. This is so troubling and disconcerting, and it places members of law enforcement at unnecessary risk of possibly losing their lives." He went on to say that it was thanks to Narcan that the trooper hadn't died. But here's the problem. It's nearly impossible to overdose from exposure in the air or on the skin to heroin or the powerful and dangerous synthetic opioid fentanyl. Yesterday, the state police put out a follow-up press release stating the following. The substance the trooper encountered has been identified as heroin. The results of any medical tests must remain confidential due to the trooper's personal privacy rights. The ultimate cause of the incident in March is inconclusive. Though not explicit, this new information suggests that the trooper did not overdose on fentanyl or heroin. I have asked the state police to clarify that point, but their public information officer, Adam Silverman, points to medical privacy rights as a reason the state police is unable to say anything further about the incident. Throughout this incident, the state police and Vermont's public safety department have been taken to task for perpetuating a myth that chance exposure to powerful opioids, as opposed to purposeful injection or swallowing of them, can lead to an overdose for first responders or others who encounter these drugs. Today on Vermont Edition, we're going to learn more about fentanyl, the synthetic opioid that has caused so many fatal overdoses in Vermont and elsewhere. We're going to talk about what it is, how it works in the body, and we're going to spend time looking at how you can and how you cannot overdose on this drug. And joining us for this discussion are two people who know this substance very well and can answer all of your questions about it. Chris Bell is Director of Emergency Preparedness, Response, and Injury Prevention at the Vermont Department of Health. He was a paramedic for 25 years. Chris, it's nice to have you on the program again.
Jane, good to be here. Thanks for having me.
And Dr. Ike Blohm is an emergency medicine physician and a medical toxicologist at the University of Vermont Medical Center. Dr. Blohm, it's a pleasure to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
So I know that neither of you can answer specific questions about this incident in particular, but the state police, as I said, did clarify that the substance the trooper came into contact with or collected as evidence is heroin. It did not say that that's what caused this trooper's collapse in the parking lot of the New Haven Barracks sometime after collecting this evidence. And again, it included a syringe and it included a bag of heroin, according to the state police. Given that you can't talk about this specific incident, Dr. Blohm, why is it extremely unlikely in situations like this, where somebody, an emergency responder, comes into the presence of an opioid, that an overdose would occur?
So as you said earlier, fentanyl is a very powerful drug, but in order to work, the drug actually needs to reach your brain. In order to get to your brain, it needs to be absorbed by the body, and drug users do this by directly injecting it or insufflating it, meaning snorting it through the nose. However, if you were to come in contact with a drug through your skin, for example, the skin is just simply not very good at absorbing fentanyl. So to absorb a dose high enough to actually make you toxic is highly, highly, highly unlikely through the skin.
How much – what would you have to do to make that happen?
Well, without giving out free advice on how
sure.
to get high.
Yes, exactly.
The absorption is determined by three factors. How much drug is on you, how big of a skin area is covered with the drug, and how long do you leave it on there? So to have an incidental exposure where you are covered with a little bit of powder for a couple of minutes is unlikely to result in significant absorption.
Now, people often say, but there are pain patches that are designed to be put onto your skin that contain fentanyl legally as a pain medication that is designed to be absorbed into your skin. So why is it not the same?
Well, the patches have a chemical composition that drives the drug into your skin. First of all, it's not just simply placed on there. And the pain patches take a long time to work. In fact, it takes about 14 to 24 hours to reach kind of plateau levels of the drug. So you need to leave the patch on there for several hours before the local tissue is saturated with fentanyl, before it actually enters the bloodstream and then travels through your brain.
And again, so if you have dry powder on dry skin, I mean, one of the things that the CDC and other places say is if you come in contact with this kind of synthetic opioid, wash it off with soap and water, but don't use alcohol because that is likely to increase absorption into the skin. But dry powder on dry skin, not likely to cause any kind of adverse reaction.
That is correct. Just mechanical removal is important.
So, Chris Bell, if somebody was overdosing on fentanyl, how quickly would one go from exposure to symptoms?
Well, you know, thanks, Jane. I'm glad you highlighted, if I can step back for a second,
yes,
I'm glad
please,
you
yeah,
highlighted
go ahead.
The just the overall risk, and that fentanyl is a real risk in Vermont and in our community. And, you know, we've had over 100 Vermonters die last year of unintentional overdose, and more than half of those involved fentanyl or one of its analogs. But those were all people who were ingesting it, as Dr. Bloom said, either by snorting or by injecting it directly into the bloodstream. And so that's really where the significant risk is. As he mentioned, there are a number of factors that go into how fast and what gets absorbed. If you inject it direct into the bloodstream after an opiate injection in the hospital or in an EMS unit, you see the reaction, you see the results within a matter of sometimes seconds. If you were to snort it, and it's a little bit slower, we're talking on several minutes, and then through other routes it can be even longer, and as he mentioned, through the skin, it's inordinately long. So it's a very, very long time before you'd see the effects.
And what are the symptoms of an overdose?
Right. So for opiates in general, and this goes for heroin, fentanyl, or any of the prescription opiates like OxyContin or oxycodone people might be prescribed, the person begins to get tired, they get sleepy, they start to lose consciousness, their breathing slows, and their breathing becomes more shallow. And ultimately, that's the risk and the pathway that kills people from an opiate overdose. Is they don't breathe, or they don't breathe enough until their heart or their brain or another vital organ is damaged to the point where it can't recover.
What are the symptoms that are being reported in these widespread cases of presumed exposure that police officers and other first responders have mentioned? Because the incident like the one in Vermont is not not alone. We've seen this, we've heard about this in other cases in other states around the country. Are the symptoms that these first responders are experiencing the same as the symptoms of an opioid overdose?
Right, and I'll let Dr. Bloom go as well, but what I see from the reports and what we see in the professional journals are most commonly we see symptoms like chest pain, like rapid heart rate, numbness and tingling in extremities or around the mouth, things like this, and those are not consistent with an opiate overdose or the symptoms we'd expect to see and the pathway we'd expect to see.
I'm going to come back to Dr. Bloom in a moment, but Chris Bell, you were a paramedic for a number of years, and one of the pushbacks that I've heard from first responders is that some people say sometimes these are the symptoms of a panic attack. Now, many of the first responders, including police officers, have been highly trained to cope well in very high pressure, very dangerous situations, and they say we are not likely to have a panic attack
right. Just
because we think we've been exposed to fentanyl. So you know, this question of panic attack, I think, sometimes feels a little bit insulting.
It does. I think it almost feels like an accusation, and that's unfair. And that's a great point, Jane. We first responders, one of our major, our primary responsibilities is to keep them safe and keep them able to help others, and that's what they're out there for as well. Where we see with new and emerging risks oftentimes is it's difficult, particularly when it's not a risk you can see or something with which you're very familiar, to quantify your individual risk. And I think that happens certainly on a conscious but also a subconscious level. You know, when you're talking about an infectious disease, we have this kind of uncertainty and fear of how do I protect myself when the Ebola outbreak was going on a few years ago, and what's the right level of personal protective equipment, and can we even take care of these people? And sure we can. We see this when something's new, when something's first out, we have less experience, we have less knowledge in the population and amongst first responders with how to protect themselves, and that's an important thing and something that we need to do as agencies that administer, agencies that train and provide equipment for them to go out, is as we learn more, as we have more experience, more data, more science behind it, that we can take what initially we have as a kind of a more conservative or an extra cautious approach, and we can tailor that back to what is the right level that's protective of our providers, but also is workable and something we can use to respond in the community. One of the big risks, I think, in, you know, one of the counterarguments is, well, what's the other side of this? Why shouldn't we just, you know, anytime there's any question, administer Narcan or assume this is the case? And the risk is those more than 100 Vermonters who died last year in overdose injected or inhaled it, and they are in that moment. That is a time-sensitive, urgent emergency, and what we'd hate to do would see responders stay outside because they weren't aware of the right precautions to take or that they didn't need much precaution and not save the person's life. And that's what we want. That's kind of the balance. That's what we want to try to get to, that right spot of protecting our responders while letting them do their jobs that they're out there to do.
Well, and also it's worth saying that in many cases, the person responding to an overdose is not a trained first responder. It may be a friend or a family member who may have Narcan available because they know that they are with or love somebody who uses opioids. And so the responder may not be somebody who's been trained in emergency protocol at all. And if that person doesn't, if that person believes that they could be exposed right. to fentanyl, they may not respond.
Absolutely.
Listeners, we're talking about fentanyl. We're looking specifically first at the risk of exposure and overdose because of exposure, this sort of contact that you can have with fentanyl through one way or another. In this case, we're talking about an emergency responder, but certainly many of us know people who are using opioids and might come in contact with this kind of substance. So what do you do? What is the protocol? What is the actual risk? We're talking about that. We're also going to go deeper into what fentanyl is and why it is so incredibly dangerous. So, Dr. Blum, what about, where do you come into this part of the conversation about the sort of perpetuation of this myth and whether that's dangerous or not? Because as Chris Bell said, in some ways you do want to take the utmost precaution. Fentanyl is dangerous. So why not think, even if there's a small risk of exposure, let's just make sure that everybody is really, really cautious.
Well, it always pays to be cautious as a first responder. You come into contact with people that have infectious diseases. You come into contact with people who are violent. But we must be certain that the caution we exercise does not impede patient care. So just like Chris said, if we get to a point where we become so cautious that we can no longer approach the patient, even though there's no actual threat to us, then we start harming people. We've seen this in medicine before. We've seen this when HIV first became apparent, that even physicians were reluctant to even shake hands with patients with HIV simply because we didn't know how it was transmitted. And ignorance, in the true meaning of the word of not knowing, gets translated into fear, and fear leads to inaction.
We got a note, a tweet from Dave, who says the most disturbing part of this situation with the Vermont State Police is that Department of Public Safety officials seem entirely unwilling to acknowledge facts that run counter to their desired outcomes. Why is Public Safety Commissioner Tom Anderson insisting that fleeting incidental exposure can lead to OD when we know that that's just not true? Dr. Blum, I know, again, you can't talk about this specific incident, but what should be the response of public safety departments, of police departments, when this kind of thing happens, and then when perhaps they learn different information than what they had thought?
I think what happened in this case, on many other cases, is that sometimes opinions are being voiced that are not based on facts, and when the facts come in later, it's hard to change your opinion publicly. It was hard for me because I used to be actually a proponent of this idea that superficial exposure could lead to toxicity, and I've posted about this on social media in the past. But the beautiful thing about science is that when the data come in, you're allowed to change your mind if the data support that. So I have since completely changed my mind about the true danger of superficial exposure to fentanyl or fentanyl analogs. And maybe in future cases, we'll just need to wait a little bit before we go public and talk about a case like this.
Why did you believe that incidental exposure could lead to overdose?
So when carfentanil hit the street, carfentanil is a fentanyl analog that is an elephant tranquilizer.
And remind us what an analog is.
An analog is something that looks similar to the original compound. It's just minor chemical modifications. carfentanil is used as an elephant tranquilizer in the veterinary world, and when that started to show up in the local drug supply, there was concern that the pharmacokinetics of the drug, meaning how well it binds to the receptors in your brain to make you toxic, would allow toxicity from just superficial exposure. That was a theoretical concern that simply did not pan out, though.
So that was what the knowledge was at the time, and so then it sort of led to this assumption that fentanyl, maybe if you were exposed to it, could do the same thing that you thought this carfentanil could. But now we have more information.
That is correct.
Today we're talking with two medical professionals who have deep knowledge of and experience with fentanyl, a synthetic opioid that is very powerful and has been blamed for many of the opioid overdose deaths in this country. Dr. Ike Blohm is an emergency medicine physician and a medical toxicologist at the UVM Medical Center. Chris Bell is director of emergency preparedness, response, and injury prevention at the Vermont Department of Health. He was also a paramedic for 25 years. So let's talk a little bit about why fentanyl is around at all. You know, we talked a little bit about the potential for superficial exposure being very low, or superficial exposure leading to overdose being very low. But why is there fentanyl around anyway? And Chris Bell, could you talk a little bit first about, you know, why it's in our drug supply?
Yeah, absolutely. So that's a business decision from the illicit drug manufacturers, the illicit drug market supply chain. Heroin is grown from a plant. It's grown in poppies. It's grown primarily overseas. It's an expensive process to make and ship and get into the U.S. in the processed form. Fentanyl and its analogs are laboratory produced. They can be produced in greater quantity at a lower cost, kind of a cost per unit of therapeutic effect or how much of the opiate effects you get for it. And so what we see is the opiate manufacturers and distribution chains mixing fentanyl or one of their analogs into the drug supply to kind of extend their product and be able to sell more for a less overhead cost, if you will. We've seen that change over the last few years in Vermont. While I'm knocking on wood as I say it, we've yet to find carfentanil in Vermont. We've quite a few of the other fentanyl analogs. About 4 years ago when we took a survey of it, we were running at about 30% of the samples seized by law enforcement had fentanyl or one of its analogs. Most recently, as of last September or so, that was up to around or just over 50% of the samples seized had fentanyl or one of its analogs. So there's significant amount in the drug supply already in Vermont.
So you mentioned fentanyl and some of its analogs, and we talked about carfentanil, which is used as an elephant tranquilizer. Fentanyl is something like, what, 100 times stronger than heroin? Is carfentanil just even stronger, or is there a different concern?
No, it is. And there's a little how strong it is and the numbers that usually get thrown around about how much more powerful it is than morphine or than heroin are a little confusing because it sometimes relates to the binding effect. Sometimes it relates to the therapeutic effect somebody might feel in the body. So those numbers aren't a hard and fast comparison. But yes, carfentanil is another order of magnitude greater in strength and potentially risk than fentanyl is as well.
Dr. Blohm, is fentanyl dangerous in and of itself, or is the risk because people think they're taking one thing and actually there's fentanyl or more fentanyl than they expect in their heroin, for example? I mean, presumably there is a quote unquote safe amount of fentanyl. It's used in legal pain medication. So the problem here and the reason it's leading to overdoses is because it's so strong and people don't know how much of it they're getting into their bloodstream. Into their brain?
There's a saying in toxicology that the dose makes the toxin. I give fentanyl to my patients almost on a daily basis. If you break a leg, for example, and we need quick pain control, fentanyl is an amazing medication to use. The problem is that the local drug supply is not FDA controlled, unlike the medication that I administer in the emergency department. So you don't have a quality control about how much fentanyl is actually in the drug. You may not even know that that's what you're getting. And the end user doesn't really have the means to quantify the amount of fentanyl in their own drug supply that they purchase, so they use a certain amount of powder that they're used to using, not knowing how much they're actually going to inject.
Right, because you may think of, you know, that sort of level or size or amount of powder as a dose, but if you don't know what's actually in that powder, you have no concept of what the dose of what is that you're taking.
Yes, and it's a common practice among drug users to sample a little bit to gauge the toxicity. Because at the end of the day, people don't want to die. That's not why they're using drugs. They want to get high. Heroin is an alkaloid. Heroin tastes bitter when you taste it. Fentanyl does not. So you can taste the – you can, for example, taste a little sample of what you have and kind of by the bitterness try to gauge how strong this is, but you can taste the fentanyl.
So people – there's not a really good way to even do that sort of quick quality control to check what you're getting.
There are now available some test kits that are being distributed, but they only tell you yes or no for fentanyl. They don't tell you how much.
And in some cases, people are looking for fentanyl.
Unfortunately, yes. People, as said, try to get high, and fentanyl is very powerful, and the idea is that you get more bang for your buck with life-ending consequences.
If I can just add a little bit context to that as well, we often that's one of the narratives we hear very frequently is that some people will always go out and search for the more powerful version of whatever type of drug you're referring to. Most commonly, when we actually do the survey data, we find that's a very small percent of people, on the order of a single to a couple percent of folks who at any time who are using are actually going out looking for that particular drug or for that. The rest, and I would say most, I think recognize, and particularly in Vermont, they recognize that this is a high risk and a higher risk activity and that they can very well die, and they probably have friends and family members potentially who have died from it as well. So that's less common is what we tend to see.
Chris, why wouldn't, you know, if this is, if fentanyl is in some ways easier to produce for illicit drug makers, mm-hmm. why wouldn't they just put fentanyl out on the streets? And it would be an easier thing to know the dose because you know that that's actually what you're getting. You're not taking heroin that's laced with fentanyl. You're taking fentanyl, and you could take a specific amount. Why is that not happening?
Well, as Dr. Bloom indicated, the FDA doesn't yet regulate the illicit drug market. And that's, the way this is produced, you picture a big table with a pile of white powder on it with a little extra white powder mixed in that gets shifted around and mixed together, but you don't have great consistency. You don't know from one baggie to the next how much of the heroin and how much of the fentanyl is there. And then the fentanyl itself would be in such minute quantities. If you actually had just pure fentanyl, we're talking about minute quantities. I don't know that that would even be an effective method of distribution.
What do you think, Dr. Blum? I mean, sure, the FDA doesn't regulate illicit drugs, but supply and demand is still in play here in some ways.
Yes, I think we're headed that way, that over time fentanyl will replace heroin. There is a fungus right now that affects opioid poppies in the Middle East, so the heroin yield will be significantly lower. That will drive the fentanyl market even further. Fentanyl in itself is so powerful that about a grain of sand's worth of fentanyl, if you have it pure, is enough to get you high. That's very unwieldy to administer, so it needs to be cut, it needs to be diluted before it reaches the end user. However, in order to transport it, some of the fentanyl is shipped through the U.S. mail, for example, you want it as concentrated as possible. So there's no quality control after the concentrated shipment to the cutting process of when it reaches the street of how much it is cut and not even what it's cut with.
And to be fair, the people in the illicit drug manufacturing business are not looking primarily out for their customers, right? They're primarily looking out for the business, and this is a fast, make the money as fast as they can. And, you know, to the extent that they can have repeat business, I think obviously they would try to do that, but they I imagine them not losing a great deal of sleep when something like this happens.
You were just mentioning concentrated fentanyl and how highly toxic it can be in very, very small quantities. And Doug writes in wondering about that and then the superficial exposure. Doug says, what about highly concentrated fentanyl? Would that not be more dangerous for skin contact or inhalation? Dr. Bloom?
Again, the surface area is so small that a grain of sand has or that amount of fentanyl has on the skin that the amount that you can absorb is very minute. And the example I give people to kind of help alleviate fears is if fentanyl were this toxic that just minimal contact with the skin, even in the most concentrated form, would kill you, everybody in the drug supply chain would be dead by now, because the drug manufacturers, the mules, the packers, the distributors, the cutters, everybody comes into the contact with that powder, but not everybody drops dead.
And what about having that powder in the air? I mean, everybody knows that powder can get into the air. So what's the risk of exposure for inhalation?
So you can snort fentanyl. It has a relatively decent bioavailability, meaning it gets absorbed relatively well. But an incidental inhalation of just a little bit of dust in the air, again, is not a sufficient dose.
Chris, we had a caller who didn't want to be on the air but was curious if there's any danger of first responders having exposure and potential overdose if they have any open wounds of some type.
Pardon me. Well, that's a great question. That's as Dr. Bloom indicates, the skin is an amazing barrier that we have, and it's an intact skin is very, very protective against biologic agents and chemical agents like this. That would be, in theory, a potential way for it to get in, but a first responder would be covering an open wound, right? So that's if I'm going to work as a paramedic on an ambulance and I got a cut cooking dinner last night, I'm going to make sure that that's covered over because, frankly, fentanyl isn't even on the top 10 or 100 lists of things I'm worried about getting into an open wound. So, that would, in theory, have a greater risk. But I think in practice, we're still talking about such a small amount. And within minutes of having some kind of wound, your body has already started to heal it. And so the absorption is not the same as if it were an open blood vessel.
You know, we've talked a lot about what happens when somebody who is not trying to come into contact with opioids comes into contact with opioids. And fentanyl can often be in heroin, as Chris Bell said, something like maybe 50%. But most commonly, it's people who are using opioids who are going to come into contact with fentanyl and with heroin. So what should people who are using opioids know about fentanyl and how, you know, how to sort of protect themselves as best they can, given how dangerous fentanyl is and how difficult it can be to figure out not just if it's in your heroin, but how much of it is in your heroin? Dr. Blum, what should people be knowing and what can people do?
So there's a couple of things that people can do. The first thing I would like to encourage is to seek treatment for the addiction. And at the University of Vermont, we actually facilitate this. We're now prescribing buprenorphine from the emergency department with guaranteed follow-up. So there's a way out. For people who are not at that point yet in the cycle of their addiction who continue to use, it is important to use with somebody there who is sober, meaning somebody can call for help. It is important to have naloxone or Narcan available at home. And I treat Narcan as a fire extinguisher. If you have a flame in your house, you should have a fire extinguisher, meaning if you have opioids in your house, even if they're for a medical condition, you should have Narcan in your house as well.
But when you say you should have somebody who's sober with you, if you're overdosing on fentanyl, you are unlikely, extremely unlikely, to be able to say, get the Narcan or to administer it yourself. So you need somebody else there who can do it.
That is true. Before respiratory depression sets in, you fall asleep. So you need to have somebody there that monitors you. There is currently a device that is being developed that can sense oxygen levels in the bloodstream and automatically inject Narcan if that goes down, but that is not on the market yet.
And if I can add in just a couple other harm reduction messages that we typically try to add in, I completely agree with Dr. Williams as well. Author options we provide are that you should use less than you normally do, you should use slower than you normally do, and then make sure you, if someone does experience an overdose, in addition to using and having Narcan, call 911, because there are myriad things that some can make somebody fall unconscious. Certainly, overdose is one of them, but there's lots of other things can be. And particularly if other drugs are involved, Narcan only reverses opiates. It doesn't work if you have other drugs on board. So call 911 and get emergency medical services on the way just in case, and so they can help make sure that the person has the best chance of survival.
If you are the person who has Narcan or who comes into contact with somebody who you suspect may be overdosing on opioids, but you don't know, I think one of the questions that we've been getting some good information, but people may wonder still is it safe for me to administer Narcan to somebody if I don't know what they took or if they took a combination of drugs and I think I've got the Narcan, but is this going to do something bad to them? Chris Bell, what should they do?
Yeah, they should give Narcan. So what the simplest, I mean, there are lots of the constellation of symptoms that are most common with opiate ingestion we've talked about. But what we tell people for simplicity is if you find someone who is unconscious, you can't wake them up, go ahead and administer the Narcan. The form that we distribute with partner agencies and organizations through about 45 sites for free around the state is the nasal atomizer. It's as easy to use as a nasal spray that you buy at the drugstore. And it is, pardon me, highly effective and incredibly safe. The only action that Narcan takes in the body is to reverse opiate attachments at the brain. If they don't have any opiates on board, Narcan doesn't do anything. So you can't hurt the person if they have a seizure or they're having a heart attack by giving them Narcan. You can only help them if it ends up being an opiate overdose.
And Dr. Blum, if you give Narcan to somebody and they are overdosing on opioids, what I've heard is that they immediately come out of that overdose, they're immediately in withdrawal symptoms, and they can be both violent and angry. So is that something that's actually true in your experience? And what should first responders know about how to keep themselves safe after they've administered Narcan?
So as far as the time of onset goes, if you give Narcan by nose with a nasal spray, it takes several minutes. It does not immediately reverse it. Even if you inject it IV like we sometimes do in the emergency department, it still takes between 30 seconds to 60 seconds. How quickly you go into withdrawal from this depends on how tolerant you are to opioids and how much Narcan you gave. If you overshoot, then you will go into withdrawal. But withdrawal is much better than dying from an opioid overdose. And withdrawal is relatively benign. It makes people feel miserable. There's vomiting, there's diarrhea, there's kind of diffuse body pain. But it's not life-threatening in any way, shape, or form. Some people are a little upset when they wake up because they're embarrassed, because that's not what they wanted, because the high that they sought is now gone. And they ended up in the hospital against their will. But I've yet to see any violence directed against me or my staff after waking somebody up with Narcan.
And if I can jump in, we absolutely agree. And what we see more commonly and almost universally is, if you remember the mechanism we talked about, somebody's not breathing or not breathing enough when they're overdosing. So for those first few minutes after the naloxone works and they're starting to breathe, their brain is just waking up again. They dump adrenaline, and they get confused. They kind of fumble around. They're not sure where they are, what's going on. After a minute or two of breathing, they are the person they were before they overdosed. And so the opiate nor Narcan in and of themselves makes somebody violent, and it's a very, very rare case. And most commonly, those people who we'd assume would be violent no matter what, just because it's a Tuesday.
So, Chris, what would you like to see law enforcement, public safety officers, health departments, and journalists do to talk about the very real dangers of fentanyl while also being very clear about exposure myths?
No, I think that's a great question. Thanks. So I think we have to let the science and the evidence guide what we do and how we go forward. I think we have training and time to talk to folks and make sure that first responders both have the best information and feel comfortable asking questions, getting those things answered. Our first responders do put themselves at risk for many different things every single day. They're willing to take risks. I think they want to be informed. They want to make sure that they're protected and they can go home at the end of their shift. They're willing to do great things for us.
Dr. Blum, same question.
Same answer, essentially.
And anything that you think the media is doing wrong that you'd like us as journalists, now's your chance to tell me and tell us, you know, what are you not hearing that you think should be out there?
Well, VPR is not known as fake news, but it is a delicate balance to walk between reporting early and reporting what people locally care about and reporting the facts that are available. And I think sometimes just hedging a little bit might be important.
Thanks to both of you for being on the show, for being very clear about what fentanyl is, how it works, how it doesn't work. I appreciate both of you sharing your expertise. Chris Bell is Director of Emergency Preparedness, Response, and Injury Prevention at the Vermont Department of Health. Dr. Ike Blum is an emergency medicine physician and a medical toxicologist at the University of Vermont Medical Center. Thanks.